Hello, this is Andrew Weinberg, president of the AMFP Greater New York Chapter. Thank you for tuning in to our podcast series, Healthcare Facility Matters. AMFP is the Association for Medical Facility Professionals. This is your professional organization for everyone in the healthcare built environment. We are excited to present this series as another means to provide great content and contribute to the betterment of our industry. Please let us know what you think. And if there are topics or speakers you'd like to suggest for future episodes. Meantime, we hope you enjoy today's discussion. AMFP, your peers are here.
Welcome to Healthcare Facility Matters podcast, brought to you by AMFP. I am Kathy Dolan-Schweitzer, a people-centered strategist, author, and the president of Health Well Done, and a member of the AMFP Greater New York Podcast Committee. Our aim on the podcast is to enhance the skills of AEC professionals to develop a better healthcare built environment for healthcare institutions. We designed this podcast for busy AEC professionals just like you. Today in episode 3, moderator Grace Lynn, a senior consultant at Turner & Townsend Healthcare, will be participating in conversations between Dr. Yumin Fong, who's an oncologist, surgeon, and author, and Jeffrey Berman, principal of Jeffrey Berman Architects. Grace's conversation will present facts and innovative ideas in advancing image-guided therapy and surgery. Dr. Fong, Sanja Cuomo Chair and Chairman, Department of Surgery, City of Hope Medical Center. Jeffrey Berman is a board-certified healthcare architect, a founding member of the American College of Architects, and an author.
As the minimally invasive management of cancer patients is increasingly important, this episode will discuss facts and innovative ideas from two leaders in their areas of expertise who will share their vision and shape the future of cancer care and healthcare facilities. Welcome, Dr. Yumin Fong and Jeffrey Berman. We are so fortunate to have you both as our guest speakers today. As an architect, I find this episode unique and invaluable. I seldom hear about fellow architects co-authoring books with a physician. On top of that, Dr. Fong, you are a surgical oncologist. I am fascinated by the fusion of both your minds from divergent fields. As I understand it, Jeffrey, you have been authoring books with Dr. Fong for several years. For those architects who aspire to become authors like you, can you tell us a little bit about how the two of you embarked on this journey?
We built a whole series of 5 generations of ORs with Dr. Fong and the surgical teams at Sloan Kettering. So as that work was winding up with the production of the 4th generation, which was the Center for Image-Guided Intervention, Dr. Fong started editing these journals, and he asked me to write an article for the journal with him about some of the projects we've done and some of the technology that we developed. Some of it we developed, some of it we applied, things that were available in the market in unique ways in the ORs we built for Sloan Kettering to serve their particular specialized needs at the time.
So Grace, the field was evolving so fast, meaning designing interventional rooms, that I just wanted to make sure surgeons were educated. And that's because, again, when we put together teams to go build new things, it's so important to bring not only the people who funded and allocate the space, but also really great architects and project managers. But I was hoping to educate a whole generation of surgeons who will come to the table and not only ask for things that they think they need, but know how to go ask for it and how to converse with the architect.
I see. So Dr. Fong, you and Jeffrey have innovatively shaped the operating rooms. Tell us about the evolution of the ORs, Since you both have been writing about the multidisciplinary approach to interventional oncology, what would you consider groundbreaking since your first co-authorship?
Yeah, I'm going to take all of us back even further, okay? Until 1953, ORs were just ORs, okay? Meaning that it was just a room where you actually had adequate lighting and then you were ready to go. And that's because surgery was all open and nothing. And there wasn't really specialty ORs. And in 1953, open heart surgery started, okay? And suddenly they needed a bigger room so that we can actually have pumps. So they would put people on bypass and take people off bypass. The big change was just a bigger space, and then you need additional lighting for the pump specialists so that they can actually see all the gauges and do all the right things. And but that was it. And then 1985 happened, and laparoscopy came. And that was the beginning of laparoscopy. The first cholecystectomy done by laparoscopy was done. Then suddenly people realized there was a different way of seeing. We could actually bring little cameras in and see suddenly all these new electrical pieces of equipment were coming into the OR, and displays were coming to the OR, and you needed to be able to see them and have the whole team be able to see them. And so that then ORs really changed. But when Jeffrey and I started working on interventional ORs, it was really the rise of interventional radiology, Grace. It was amazing that now we have colleagues who can actually use needles and catheters and operate on inside a patient without opening patients up at all. And but they required very advanced imaging. And so Jeffrey and I were building the Center for Image-Guided Interventions at Sloan Kettering. It was 15 rooms, all with advanced imaging. It was quite a forward-thinking center. Suddenly we had to put heavy pieces of imaging equipment in the room, and then also allow the anesthesiologist to take good care of the patients and have images displayed so we can actually use them. And then we also I had to bring the surgeon, the interventional radiologist, and the endoscopist, since everybody was now using all these advanced imaging techniques, into the room and have a cohesive workspace. It was actually kind of fun looking back. Jeff, I think we did a pretty good job given all the new things we had to put in the room. And then now robotics has happened. And so Jeffrey and I have actually gone in and collaborated on building robotic operating rooms where at first huge robots came in, and now smaller and smaller size robots and are coming in. So, you know, the evolution of the OR has gone in a big, big way. And our thinking about how to build them has also changed. I noticed that Jeff was now starting to build to allow all kinds of equipment to come into the same kind of space and to have many workflows come through. Jeff, you should probably describe some of that, because it's really quite interesting how, instead of a single purpose built OR, we're now thinking, how do we go in and allow all kinds of equipment to come in, but the workflows to be able to change for whatever specialty needs it.
So what we found with working on the programming and planning of many ORs at individual institutions is that there are multiple specific surgical teams and specialty teams. Each of these specialty teams has their own workflow and a unique set of instruments and needs within the room in terms of setup and flow and geometry. And what we found is that each of these teams wants their optimum setup when they're in the room working. And the difference is there are a whole series of identical needs: the surgical lights, the table, the sterile field, the gray circulation in and out of the public corridor, a sterile circulation out of a sterile core if that exists, and then zones for the scrub nurse to set up sterile instruments and manage the sterile equipment. A zone for anesthesiology to monitor the patient and supplies and meds. So you take the common elements, you plan each room for the optimum setup for each team and each set of procedures that's going on in the room. And then you come back and you look at overlays of each of the setups. And what you start to find is that given some minor changes in the exact location of the mountings of the equipment and some changes in the lengths of the arms and the arcs, you can get these pieces to serve multiple needs, multiple groups, but you can also look at the things that certain groups don't need that they find are obstructions to their workflow or operations, and you can find a way to park them out of the flow of the room. If the room's not massively too big, very often these booms and arms can reach the walls. So they park, when they're not in use, they park along the wall with the trash cans and the linen hampers and the carts, you know, that are in abeyance or in wait for them to be needed in the case. And so when you start to look at the rooms and think about them this way, you can build these optimized rooms that flex and meet the needs of different teams and different procedures completely. And it's good to have happy surgeons, especially if you're a patient.
Yeah, but you're really saying that it's good to have many happy surgeons. I guess you could always make one group happy, but if you could really design a space that can flex, then suddenly filling it up and making sure that the utilization is above whatever allows the hospital to break even in terms of and make a profit. And because again, trying to stay in the black is what everybody's trying to do in healthcare. And the more the interventional spaces are used in terms of capacity, the more likely that's going to happen. But Jeff, you brought up a number of things in there that, you know, I think we should amplify on, you know, deciding how big a room should be. Really important thing. I think oftentimes we design rooms that are just much too big, and then suddenly reaching the wall mounts for plugs is impossible, or the cords are really hazardous. And trying to make sure that the rooms are pretty uniform. I've noticed when I moved from Sloan Kettering and came to City of Hope 10 years ago. And one of the things that was a idiosyncrasy in our ORs here is that there are rooms with completely mirror images of each other, meaning that they put a door in one room on the right side of the room. So all the storage is left side dominant. And then in the adjacent room, the door is in the opposite side. Suddenly, if somebody works in room one and room two on consecutive days, they are completely backwards from each other. And it's very, very disturbing and very hard to maintain good workflow that way. And so even just making sure that all the true common elements, which are doors to the clinical core and then doors to the sterile core, are similar so that you could actually plan the rooms in a similar fashion, become important.
That's true in every functional medical space. It's true for exam rooms, in doctor's offices and primary care. It's right. It's true for x-ray rooms. It's true for patient bedrooms where the staff wants to be able to come and go in a room, you know, 20 or 40 rooms in a building, and know when they walk in, know where the patient is. When they reach up to get something, it's in the same relationship to the bed and the patient in every room. That consistency is key to doing onboarding and training and just being able to function efficiently without constantly having to think about where you are and what's going on and what's different here. That's a safety issue as much as it's a functional issue. The other thing is, most surgical teams may only work a few days a week. So the utility of building custom rooms for specific teams is really not good, because the days they're not there, either the room's empty or some other team's working there, that team doesn't want to have to compromise their workflow and process. And the institution clearly doesn't want to keep this room empty from a capital cost point of view, but also from a loss of revenue point of view. That room empty might be a minor cost to carry, but the loss of revenue to the institution can be massively substantial. Of a room one day a week, 50 weeks a year, it could be millions of dollars in revenue lost.
Yeah. Thank you both for sharing those lessons learned then that led to today's progress in the OR environment. Dr. Fong, according to Winston Churchill, we shape our buildings, thereafter they shape us. I am curious about your experience over the OR's facility lifecycle, since you, as a surgeon, are one of the beneficiaries after the ORs are designed and built. Talk to us about how ORs shape the end users, such as your clinical team and the patients. And when do you decide it's time for another renovation, especially with the rapid advancement of technology and the dynamic evolution of interventional oncology?
Our workspaces really do shape us. It's in many different parts, because if we don't have enough power in a room, meaning enough plugs, we can't actually use overlapping technologies in the same room. How high the lights are actually matters in terms of whether it could focus well on certain fields in the OR. And so again, as technology has been changing, I've actually started to change my thoughts about how to go and design it. I used to think that every time we have an amazing new piece of technology, we should design around the technology. Now, most instrument makers have come to realize if they make all of their advanced technology, all 110 plugs, for example, and all with simple gases, and all with good spaces for clearance from the ceiling, that it's much more likely to be used by many more people. We've had to design around technologies much, much less. All we have to do is design good spaces for working. So every time I think of designing new rooms, I go, how much lighting do we need? Where do we need it? How high the ceiling should be? What size should it be? What kinds of gases? What are the airflow patterns that it should be? And one of the things that we don't talk about early enough in the design is really which table we're thinking. Okay, everybody thinks that you could just generically go buy new tables, but OR tables are kind of purpose built now. And there's only one brand that right now moves with a intuitive robot. So for example, so if you are going to be setting up the rooms where the intuitive robot is going to be that bed, if it's going to be high end interventional radiology space, which bed should it be that goes with the equipment? And then where are we going to set up in the room to go do all of this? So again, it's much more trying to design so that many, many technologies could work in the same room, because we don't want it to be obsolete anytime soon. Okay, I'd like to build for at least 10 years. But again, that's why the collaboration with the architect is so important. And so one of the things I for example, it used to be that if you had to convert a space and remodel a space, you know that you needed 4 feet above the ceiling in order for all the infrastructure to sit. Now there are all these new ways of setting up the ceiling that allows for much less space and for much more clearance inside the room. And so again, working with folks like Jeff and expert architects to go figure out how well we can remodel the space in terms of all of these parameters is really, really important. Jeff, would you like to amplify on that a bit? Because again, every time I talk to you guys, I learn something new, and it tells me new ways of converting old space into modern space.
One of the things that's proven to be a great utility in terms of functionality in the rooms and speed to completion has been this modular ceiling construction. While the room and the floor infrastructure is being built, this ceiling structure can be prefabricated in a factory. It has the lighting, it has med gases, sprinklers, all the electric, it has the diffusers and the ductwork. Anything that's in the ceiling can be integrated into this structure, including the supports for all the ceiling-mounted surgical equipment. That way, that system will be hung from the structure in 4 or 6 or 8 points, which are prepared ahead of time. This modular structure is shipped on a truck. It rolls down the hallways through the doors. It's bolted in place on the floor in the room, jacked into the ceiling. The connections are already in the ceiling, ready to be made. The connections are made. The ceiling perimeter where the connections are is finished. And then all the ceiling supported equipment can be put in. It saves weeks of time in finishing the room. It helps the schedule dramatically because now we don't have to worry about seven different trades working through the same space in this one room, which is a scheduling nightmare and a coordination and logistics problem too. And then we can, looking ahead, we can see that, you know, in this room, in this institution, they're starting to do, you know, more vein grafts for cardiac surgery. So they're, at some point, they're going to need a third or a fourth light at the foot of the table to do vein harvesting while the chest is being prepped, or they're going to be doing robotics work. So they're going to want a boom to service the robot with the robot connections and the stereo display for the robot, so that the staff in the room who's not operating the robot from the console can see what's going on and do the support work in terms of changing instruments and adjusting the robot. So we know these things are coming and we can prepare for them at a really, really minimal incremental cost. And that way, when the institution decides they need them, when the volumes come up or the capital allocation to buy the equipment hits the budget, we know we can come in a couple of days, maybe over a weekend, do the final fit out and the install of the new technology, and the room's ready to go that next week. So the cost, the impact to the institution is minimized, and the utility of making that upgrade is made quite simple with a little forethought on the early planning side.
Thank you, Dr. Fong and Jeffrey, for imparting your wisdom today. We will be back to talk about your vision of the future of the OR and the IR environments.
As we wrap up this podcast, I want to thank our guest speakers and moderator for sharing their visual stories used to educate both surgeons and medical facility professionals. Our members crave to understand technologies and workflows in healthcare facilities. Thank you for joining us today. And if you enjoyed this conversation, please check out our website at amfp.org/NYC to learn more about AMFP. And episode 2 will drop in the next few weeks, so please be on the lookout. This podcast series, Healthcare Facilities Matters, is brought to you by AMFP NYC Chapter Podcast Committee members. Until next time,